hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, California cracks down on contractors. And Richard, we take as our subject today AB 5, which is a new piece of legislation that's just taken effect in California, and which is causing a fair bit of disruption. The idea here amongst the lawmakers who wrote this piece of legislation was that California needed to crack down on companies that rely heavily on independent contractors. In the initial rhetoric around it, this was focused largely on ride-sharing companies like Uber and Lyft, though, as we'll discuss in a moment, it ended up ensnaring a lot of other industries too. So maybe before we even get into what the legislation does, we should sort of dissect its core argument, because the policymakers who passed this are arguing that the big problem is that some of these gig economy companies are essentially gaming the system and giving contractor status to people who should be considered employees. So how strong a case do they have? What is the legal distinction between those two statuses?
Well, this is, of course, a very delicate and complicated question. I could give you the formal test, and then you have to see how it plays out. Essentially, an employer is somebody who instructs an employee not only on the ends to be achieved, but also the means to be used. And typically, people only work for single persons rather than for multiple guys. An independent contractor is somebody who's given a task by the so-called employer, and he or she chooses the particular techniques that are to be done. Most independent contractors tend to work for multiple parties, and so it becomes very difficult to attribute to them an employee status for anyone. It's even easier to call somebody an independent contractor if it turns out itself to be a corporation or a partnership. So you go out and hire XYZ plumbing company to fix your sink. It's pretty clear that's going to be a situation. But if it turns out that you run an apartment complex and you hire somebody to fix all your sinks all the time, and they work for you 30 hours a week, and you decide that these people are independent contractors and not employers, people are going to start to apply the control test and say, no. What you're trying to do is to ditch various forms of obligation. There are two forms of obligation, and they should, I think, merit very different responses. One of them is the important question, not much in evidence in this dispute, of whether or not what happens if a given individual causes harm to a third person outside the employment relationship. So if you're an independent contractor and when you mess up a pipe, it damages somebody next door, the person who owns the building is not going to be responsible. If it turns out that you're an employee, then the doctrine of vicarious liability will carry over. This is not particularly important today because the way insurance companies' contracts are often written is they cover both the independent contractor on the one hand and the employer, and then later you try to figure out the loss between them. So you protect the third party by giving blanket coverage. Between the two parties, it becomes an absolute nightmare because it turns out that the basic distinction that I'm talking about conceals thousands upon thousands of small permutations, many of which get very close to the line. For a whole variety of reasons, it is often the case that both, stress the word both, the employer and the so-called employee would prefer to have an independent contractor relationship. People do not need Social Security. They don't want to have employers, six or seven of them, all of which pay in Social Security. They want to have the various flexibility to turn down kinds of jobs of one sort or another. And in effect, what they want to say is, I'm better off as an entrepreneur than I am as an employee, because I could choose my own hours, choose my own clients, choose my own rides, and so forth. And so what happens is this population of so-called fake employees is divided between people who love the status and some people who are generally aggrieved. So if you go back and try to poll all of the Uber and the Lyft drivers and some of the truck drivers, maybe 40% of them would like steady work and would prefer to be employees, and probably 60% of them would want to go the other way around. And so if you have a uniform rule that covers all of them, people are going to be disgruntled. So what a market does is it says if a person wants to be an employee and the company is so inclined to do so, they can enter into an employment relationship. On the other hand, if you want to work for multiple parties and keep flexibility, you can designate your relationship as an independent contractor and go about your business enjoying the flexibility over hours and routes chosen and the like. My own view about all of this is that when you try to take an incredible array of complicated businesses and say there's one cast iron distinction between the two things, and you try to put a test on it, what happens is you get errors of over and under inclusion. And it turns out, since this is a regulatory scheme, you can't change it by voluntary agreement. And to make it even worse, even if the employee is willing to look the other way, the state, perhaps at the instance of many of the unions, is entitled to enforce the particular rules against the employer, even if the worker does not. So there's a widespread reluctance on the part of any major employer, given public employment, to break this. And so you're going to start to see in a whole variety of industries, not only the Uber and Lyft types, but most importantly in things like freelancers of one kind or another, whether it's people who do music or write stories or things of that particular sort, a real sense that they have gotten the worst end of this deal, because typically these people work for 10, 20 given persons during the course of the year, and employment status for 30 people makes no sense for anybody.
So walk us through what AB 5 actually does, how it changes the status quo in California for consideration of employees versus contractors.
Well, what it does is it takes judicial decisions which said, in effect, you can't characterize these drivers as essentially independent contractors because the employer has too much control over the way in which they do things, the way they get paid, the kind of cars they drive, and so forth. So everybody now goes into this other class of cases. What happens is that there are many, many people who want to be exempt from this. And so what the statute tries to do is the Herculean task of taking various kinds of professions, accountants, lawyers, and so forth, and putting them outside that particular area rather than putting them in. But this process of inclusion and exclusion is highly imperfect. And so what happens is you get many, many individuals who say, you know what, I don't like this particular classification. Can I get out of it? And it turns out they can. So Vox, which was strongly in favor of the law, ends up saying, well, we have to fire most of our independent freelancers because we can't put them on the payroll and hope for them to work for 20, 30, or 40 hours a week. We want them for a story every other week. We want to do 6 or 7 hours a month. And you do this for 7 or 8 outlets, you've all of a sudden got a living. And so you see as many people even thinking of leaving the state because it turns out that the nature and the rhythm of their work is something which doesn't match. On the other hand, when this thing was put forward, there was a kind of a Marxist tinge to it. And if you start looking at what Lorena Gonzalez said, who's the chief architect of these things, it was all the model of Marxist exploitation in which she said abstract forms of corporate greed are made very concrete by the ways in which these people essentially squeeze the lifeblood out of their employees. So it's all an exploitation model. And since it's all an exploitation model, anything you do to stop exploitation ought to be a fine thing. So what happens is she does not believe the old capitalist quote-unquote maxim that voluntary contracts work for the mutual gain of both parties. She's convinced that this is corrupt. And since it's corrupt, she manages to stamp it out. Uber may be a giant corporation, but there are many employers who are covered by this statute whose net worth is $1 million, $2 million, or even less, no semblance of big size or market power. One of the things they could have done, but they didn't want to do, was to say that any employer whose annual revenues are less than $5,000 is out from underneath the statute, which would make a huge difference. But they're always worried that what happens, you have a big company of, say, $8 million, and you divide it into two smaller companies in order to avoid the regulation. And so what they do is they're always in favor of overkill, even if it means you captures others. This is an absolute standard problem with respect to regulation. The coverage provisions never map into the people whom you want to get covered, and they always go a little bit broad because they know there's going to be an effort to duck this. And then when they go over broad, they drive people out of the state or into bankruptcy and so forth. So this is going to be a constant ache. And my guess is that the ultimate solutions will come from individual people who go to the state legislature and said, you know, we are a bunch of people who play for weddings and we play in temples and churches and so forth. And the statute says if you play music in a place which plays music by other people, you have to be an employee, not an independent contractor. So the fact that a church may have an organist now means that the trio that comes into play for the wedding could be covered. And they say this is crazy. Now, there's going to be a lot of receptiveness to this. And then the question is, what do you do? With Ms. Gonzalez around, you will never back off the major premise. The question is, what kinds of fixes you could put into the statute? Will there be retroactive? What kinds of changes could you make in the fines and in the enforcement stuff to make this tolerable? Because there is at least some danger that there will be a bleed. People in the state will leave the state to get the work. Or even if they want to stay inside the state, the work will leave as people will hire people in Idaho, Oregon, New Mexico to cover things that otherwise take place in California.
I want to shift to the legal side of this because one of the other remedies that's being discussed is challenges to this law in court. And we'll talk about some of the arguments that have the best chance of success in that venue. But I want to start with one that you said in a recent piece for Defining Ideas probably wouldn't succeed, but should. And that's the argument for freedom of contract. People should be able to make their own labor arrangements on their own terms. Give us a sense of why that's not likely to work, how that has diminished over the years as a persuasive argument in court.
Well, what happens is there's a kind of a pretty straight down line from a famous case called Lochner against New York, decided in 1905, where it was originally held that a statute which required there be a maximum number of hours that you could work per week and day was struck down on the grounds that it upset the ability of the workers to determine their own fate. And it was a mix of you can't be paternalist for grown-up people, and you can't be monopolistic against various kinds of firms. This was then extended about 10 years later so that the law provided both in the federal and the state context that the state could not force an employer to bargain with a union, which had some degree of monopoly power. Individual workers in the firm both had freedom of contract, and that could not be done. The New Deal comes along, and it's very clear that the model of industrial might as being unproductive carried the day. This was the language of the New Republic with prominent writers like Felix Frankfurter in the period, say, between 1915 and 1925. In 1930, Frankfurter is the lead author on a book called The Labor Injunction, which again starts to talk about how it is that in order to make sure that employers are not unionized, they manage to get injunctions against union organizations, which was the truth. Then you get all of the statutes of the New Deal situation, which treat the exploitation model as accurate. And instead of banning all contracts, what they do is they start putting in a number of restrictions on contracts, all of which become enforced. And so the ones that are most conspicuous are the 1935 National Labor Relations Act. And what that does is it says that individual employees cannot bargain with employers. There is a union. It is selected by majority vote within a given unit. And then the employer is duty bound to bargain with this unit. It cannot go to the individual workers who don't like it. The dissenting workers are nonetheless bound by that. And then you pound out a collective bargain agreement. It turns out, if you read much of the recent literature that is put forward, this New Deal disaster, as far as I'm concerned, is now treated as a sort of solution to inequality of bargaining power and so forth. So the idea is very much allowed. And then there's something known as the Fair Labor Standards Act. And what that does is it puts minimum wage laws in place and overtime regulations in place, and all of that stuff was upheld. So if you now look at this particular problem, the restriction on freedom of contract with respect to these independent contractors, and posit this imbalance or inequality of bargaining power, these kinds of precedents look extremely strong in order to keep the current system alive. That is the regulation alive. The difficulty, I think, is there's a lot of, shall we say, collateral damage that is caused to all these people on both sides that are done. And the issue that you then have to worry about is whether or not, given the new wage of Trump judges, they will shed their version of judicial restraint and start to say, look, if it's for the mutual gain, you got to let it go unless you can prove there's corruption in the formation of the contract. Not really possible if these guys go to work on daily contracts that always have the same term. Whether or not you're trying to collude to hurt third parties, these are not cartel type arrangements. And so if you look at the standard reasons why it is under the earlier age that certain contracts would not be enforced, the Lochner principles would clearly defend this one. So I think, in effect, you're going to have to get a major worldview on this. And the arguments are, well, Professor Epstein, you may be right about this contract, but it's surely for the legislature to define. It's not a question of individual rights. It's a question of social justice and so forth. My view is it's a question of individual rights, just the way individual claims for individual speech or religious freedom are individual claims. But that is not the law today. So what you have to do is to figure out, is there any other way that you could skin this cat, if not for every kind of a worker covered by AB 5, but at least for some?
Okay, so let's turn to some of those arguments that you think might have a fighting chance in court. There's an equal protection claim being made here. Would you think that might be persuasive? Explain the logic there.
Well, it might be. What happens is the Equal Protection Clause says, essentially, you have to treat like cases alike, even though it doesn't tell you which way you have to treat those cases. So it's a non-discrimination sort of provision. And the argument that people will try to make is if you start looking to the crazy quilt pattern of exceptions and inclusions inside the statute, that some of them look to be so arcane and so arbitrary that even under a very low standard of review, did not work. And so this will not be the wholesale statute. This will not knock out the Uber and the Lyft stuff. But if you start talking about people trying to work for choirs or for florists or for small kinds of people, and which ones are covered and which ones are not, the real uncertainty about the knowledge, the heavy penalties that are going to be imposed, the huge burdens to try and find regulatory clarity by hiring lawyers and so forth, somebody may say enough is enough and strike it down. I regard that as well less than a 50% chance, but it certainly has the following thing. I've never seen a labor statute this crazy, and nor is anybody else, or convoluted. And so the judges may say enough is enough. Because remember, if you get into federal court, there are many Trump-type judges now in the Ninth Circuit, and it's quite clear that the balance of power is to some extent shifting. And I think there's also a lot of residual resentment against this. So if you pick the right plaintiff as some poor, helpless Joe, who is absolutely overwhelmed by these things and faces bankruptcy, economic ruination, you may be able to tap a wellspring and say, well, this freedom of contract stuff isn't as bad as we wanted to think. This is not big union guys being smashed down by big coal companies so that their workers are forced to do things that are against their will, dangerous, unhealthy, and so forth. And somebody's going to try it. And they'll try it with particular facts going on as to why it is that in their particular case, the early arrangement mattered. So I have to take care of my sick mother. You tell me I have to be a full-time driver. It turns out that I can't stay home on Tuesday afternoons. And at this particular point, I have to quit my entire job, running out of finances, have to leave states. You can see people telling tales of woe that might resonate. And that will be the strategy. And the question is, how many can you get? But as I said, that's a kind of a war of attrition. And it's not likely to produce major results unless it produces a change in political conviction. And given the way Ms. Gonzalez talks about this stuff, she is all too much the true believer.
Now, the law also introduces this issue with freelance journalists, which you mentioned earlier. There's a cap of 35 pieces per year. So even if you're just a weekly columnist, you run afoul of this. Yeah. You mentioned in your Defining Ideas piece that there's a potential that this introduces a rationale for the First Amendment to be in play here. Walk us through that.
Well, essentially what happens is the First Amendment says that you're allowed to speak. And then the general question that you have to ask is, if you're allowed to speak, are you allowed to be paid for the speech that you want to issue? And the usual response to that is the notion of freedom of speech is absolutely crazy if you're not allowed to have the ancillary right to contract for the sale of the stuff that you have. So just imagine a great novelist who's allowed to write whatever he or she wants. And then when you try to sell it to a company in exchange for royalties, what the government says, the maximum royalties on any management or anything shall be $100 a year, regardless of the book, its merits, or its contract. I think most people would start to say that those kinds of limitations so infringe the basic right of speech that they're going to be protected. You're going to be protected against these collateral intrusions. Well, now what we do is you have to face the campaign finance case, which imposes all these kinds of limitations. But in the campaign finance cases, the issue is that you're trying to give somebody some money in order to give a message in exchange for which what you hope to get is some legislative advantage by that person championing regulations, changes in regulations, and so forth that work for you. So there is a broad rubric called corruption in the free speech cases dealing with campaign financing. And in the great case on this 1976 Buckley and Vallejo, this was thought to have a lot of punch with respect to the way in which people bought favors, no punch with the ability of a Michael Bloomberg to spend $2 billion of his own money in order to buy an election or anybody of similar wealth doing that. Well, what you say is now, in this particular case, where's the corruption? I'm a freelance journalist and I write for small papers. Am I trying to rig elections? Am I trying to get political dominance? There's nothing. So what you do is you say the first half of the argument holds, that is that the freedom of speech protects against collateral infringements. But the second argument, the justification for these restrictions in the terms of some kind of limitation or protection against force, fraud, abuse, and so forth, all that stuff comes up empty. So you distinguish the cases on the defensive side, on the justificatory side, and say you win. Now, how does this work? There is in constitutional law this very important, nearly metaphysical notion turned about the standard of review. How much scrutiny do you get? And in the campaign finance cases, it's all over Robin Hill's barn, whether it's low, medium, or high scrutiny under these cases. And the higher the scrutiny, the more likely you are to invalidate the statute. When, however, you start to switch and you now go to these kinds of cases, well, what you're talking about is a journalist producing a literary or political content, I think the level of scrutiny is going to be a lot higher than it is in political cases. And so you get more protected speech and you get less justification for it. So my guess is that if these people bring this kind of case, they have a very substantial, even a better than even chance of winning this. Arguments like this have been made by telephone companies about the transmission of data over their systems, claiming essentially that they're speech providers. And if you're going to do it with respect to large content providers or transportation providers or essentially internet connectors or so forth, you certainly should be able to do it with authors. Then if you can do it with authors, the companies that want to hire these things would say, we're also hurt, and they can join in and try to have indirect standing because of the way in which their relationships are compromised, and you can do it. My guess is that all of these changes, all of these things will be challenged one way or another. It's very difficult to say which way they go. It's probably the case that you can get yourself into federal court since these things arise as claims for the protection of freedom under the First Amendment. And as we say, you know, even in California, or especially in California, there is much more of a libertarian streak amongst the federal benches than there was before. The state system is, I regard, pretty hopeless on most of these issues, but even on this free speech issue, you may be able to get some people who are traditional civil libertarians and will back off. I have no doubt that if I'm a trade association, I would certainly want to back one of these lawsuits because I think you have a pretty good chance of either winning the lawsuit or making a public relations case sufficiently strong that they'll back off and all of a sudden these freelancers can do 150 articles a year, at which point 95% of the problem may be solved.
Final question for you, Richard. AB 5, for all its flaws, it does seem to tap into a growing anxiety around the labor force, even among some of the people who a decade ago may have been techno enthusiasts and seen the gig economy as somewhat liberating. There are those who now think of it as a source of instability. And one of the big reasons for that is the fact that if your primary source of income is through contract labor, you are yourself on the hook for what might be benefits in a salaried position, which is one time consuming to navigate. You have to essentially become your own HR department at that point on everything from healthcare to taxes. And two, it's expensive. So if you're on the individual market for health insurance, for instance, it's very different from getting insurance provided through your employer. If the economy is moving more in this direction towards a greater autonomy, greater freelance labor, put AB5 to one side, are there other more market-friendly public policy changes that need to reflect that reality?
Well, look, one of the things that's so crazy is the reason that the dichotomy between the independent contractor and the employee developed is that we always laud on additional kinds of mandates and requirements with respect to the employment relationship, just as we do in many cases with respect to the insurance relationship and individual and group health care plan. And so these attached mandates are extremely high cost. And what happens is that the gains from trade are, say, 10 units per hour, and the cost of compliance of these things are 15 units per hour, the deal is going to close down. And so the way in which you make employment more attractive is not to hobble the independent contractor, it's to rethink the way in which you decide to regulate these employment contracts. And as you know, I've been on the warpath on this for my entire academic career, in which the basic position I say is, look, these labor contracts, if they're competitive, the way in which you protect the worker is give them lots of alternatives. So if an employer tries to take advantage of them, they can move somewhere else. The kinds of protections you give are to common carrier, customers of common carriers. But this is not the only railroad that takes you from New York to Boston. There are lots of choices. And so you preserve the choices and you get rid of the regulation. It's only when the choices are eliminated by the technology, like the single railroad or the single airplane, are becoming less common, that you then start having fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory terms. So I think this is absolutely suicidal. And the most common of these proposals, which you see all the time, is, let's go back to the good old days of collective bargaining. Collective bargaining was a failure, and it should have been a failure. Its percentage of market penetration without much of a change in the law went from about 35% in 1954 to about 6 or 7% today. Why is that? Because it turns out collective bargaining creates monopoly structures. Monopoly structures create heavy holdouts. They are extremely difficult to negotiate. They're even more difficult to renegotiate when you need some kind of change. And so what happens is workers become more heterogeneous and more mobile. They don't want to be union workers under these circumstances. So the whole system starts to crack. There's no way you're going to be able to recreate a successful market with collective bargaining, because you can't put together the Riva Ridge plan, in which it turns out you get 5,000 workers on assembly line. All this stuff is going to be automated in one form or another. The kinds of workers that you have are going to be doing highly idiosyncratic tasks. More and more of this is going to be telecommuting. More and more of it is going to be professional skills. More and more of it is going to be ad hoc contracts and less job classification. To try to impose a union relationship on that situation is a genuine disaster. And when the people try to do this, they're absolutely crazy. So in Illinois, when they wanted to quote unquote unionize home care workers, what they said is all of these people are now employees of the state. And what happens is the union isn't therefore entitled to bargain in order to get it. But oh, by the way, when they start to bargain, the state is not responsible for anything. These are only obligations that fall to the individual workers with respect to collecting dues and so forth. So you get really very strange efforts to try to expand unionization. And what we have to realize is the mistake is you don't want to compound the felony. You drove people into the independent contractor markets by making the standard labor contracts essentially unpalatable in many, many cases. The way to change the balance again is to get rid of the various kinds of loads that you put on this. And it's a more of a freedom of contract regime rather than a less of one. But given the progressive angst and the utter unwillingness to understand how these contractual arrangements work, you're not going to get that. If you believe, as Ms. Lorena Gonzalez does, that employers make all their money by squashing people, then your view is, I can't do anything. Nobody ever gets promoted. Nobody ever gets a salary raise. Nobody gets a new opportunity. Everybody is just being squashed down. Well, you look at the vibrant sets of the economy, and the way in which you know an economy is working very well is the number of quits exceed the number of people who are fired. Because what happens is it's new opportunity rather than failing businesses that drop it. Not going to work everywhere. God knows what the ecology of a startup is. But that's a market where unless you have very rapid employee churn, you'll never be able to succeed. And the last thing you want to do is to have the Cassandras of these situations create the angst by doubling down on a series of mistaken situations. In a free-moving economy like the one that we have, you need less regulation, not more.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at definingideas@hoover.org. And you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's @RichardAEpstein. And if you enjoy the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.